Welcome back to 106.7 The Fan. Ben Standig here with you up until 9 o'clock. We've just ran through a bunch of Commander's thoughts heading into this week's OTA, and later in the show we'll talk NBA draft and playoffs with Chase Hughes from Monumental Sports. But right now, I mean, this is exciting for me. I have not talked to her in any capacity in some time. My former partner here on these airwaves, Britt Giroli, senior MLB writer for The Athletic. She's covered the Nats and the Orioles in the past, and she's going to talk to me about those things now. Britt, how the hell are you?
Oh, I'm good, Ben. I'm good. How are you?
I mean, I'm here on a Monday night Memorial weekend talking on the radio. I mean, it could be worse. Could be better, but it could be worse.
Yeah. It's a beautiful weather, a great day. I went to the Orioles game today. Can't ask for better weather on Memorial Day. So yeah,
absolutely.
Complain.
Well, I'll get to the Orioles in a minute. That's my team. I have questions, so we'll get to them in a minute. But I'll start where I know most people want to get to, and that's of course the Nats. They've been on a bit of an uptick of late. They've won 7 of 10, still under 500. But you know, this is a team that was expected to be, you know, rebuilding and still growing. The growth though is so much centered on the prospects they got back in the Juan Soto trade, and now 4 of the 5 that they got are with the big league club. You have Robert Hassel, the latest to come up, joining Mackenzie Gore, who leads all of Major League Baseball in strikeouts. James Woods flashing the power. You know, CJ Abrams is a dynamic young shortstop. As you look at where they're at now, how did you kind of feel about the Soto trade at the time, and what's your thoughts now, seeing these guys, you know, starting to come up and produce?
Yeah, I think, you know, at the time, if people remember, Mike Rizzo got clobbered. I mean, people were saying there's just no way you can trade Juan Soto and get anything close to value back. And, you know, because A.J. Preller exists and because he long had wanted Juan Soto, the Nationals were really able to pull off a heist here. I mean, I've had numerous people tell me, and if you remember when this trade went down, Ben, no one was talking about James Wood. The real centerpiece was considered C.J. Abrams. And Wood was, I think, in A-ball, somewhere in the lower minor leagues. He was considered very far away. And because he plays with such an effortless, you know, style, he's not flashy, he's very quiet, people kind of thought that he was just low energy and maybe didn't like baseball. You know, there was a lot of people in San Diego wondering why Preller was so stuck on this guy. And, in fact, he was the guy that Preller did not want to include in that Soto trade. And Mike Rizzo has said that, you know, he wouldn't make that deal without James Wood. They liked him. And you're seeing now a superstar. He is the best player on that team. He has the highest upside on that team. I think you make that deal for James Wood and a whole bunch of guys who don't make the majors, Ben, let alone, you know, as you mentioned, they got Hassel, they got C.J. Abrams, they got Gore. Like, you're just looking at this list, and you're like, well, this is going to end up being an all-time heist, especially because we know Juan Soto is good, but you look at San Diego, and they had to trade Juan Soto, so they didn't even have him for very long. And the only way you could maybe recoup the value is if the Padres had won a World Series by pulling off this trade. That didn't happen. So I think this has been a franchise-altering move. It certainly sped up the rebuild. My question now is, when are they going to get out of this rebuild, right? Like, when are they going to take that next step forward? And I think that's a lot of what this season is going to be about.
Well, that was going to be sort of my next question. This is a great starting point with these players. But this is not the NBA where having 3 or 4 young guys can turn the whole thing around. Or it's not even the NFL where if one of those young guys is a quarterback, as we saw with the local football team, you can turn things around. Baseball, you know, you got to round out the pitching staff. Who else is part of the 9? What do you think overall where this group is at beyond just these players? Well, let's just say even Hassel shows he can stay in the league. And I know there's Dylan Cruz and a couple other guys. I'm not saying it's just these guys. But where are you at sort of with this whole situation, and what do you think they need to do to take that next step?
Yeah, you're right. Jackson Rutledge is another guy they think highly of, is going to be part of their future. You know, there's another guy, Susana, who throws, I think, 100 that was included in the Soto trade, that's on their radar certainly as well. I think when you look at the Nats, to me, as someone who doesn't cover the team every day anymore, I'm a national MLB writer, so, you know, I'm doing it from more of that macro lens. I think they need to get to a point where they're spending money in free agency. And I don't say that just, you know, because you need to spend to try to give off that vibe. I think you know, when you look at when the Nats got good the last time around, they needed these big veteran presences. They needed these Jason Worth. They needed like these guys that really helped turn things around. And I think they're getting close. They're getting to a point where, okay, we've got all these young guys. And if you look across the Beltway with the Orioles, I think a big problem is they didn't have this guy. They didn't have the veteran presence. I think they need to look at how do we support these young guys? You know, how do we continue their development up here? And a big piece of that is having some of these guys around. So I would like, you know, if the Nationals hover around that 500 mark all year, like that's great, but then they have to approach this winter as a, how do we become a playoff team, especially in the era of expanded playoffs? Like every team can get in. Teams that hover around 500 can be dangerous. So, you know, I would like to see the ownership and Mike Rizzo kind of take that next step forward and get out of that rebuild. And I think to do that, you have to consistently win. And certainly, as you said, they've had some stretches where they've looked good. You know, they swept the Orioles. They've been on a little bit of a run. They've started to kind of solidify some of the early mistakes that they had as a young team. I'd like to see them kind of supplement that team and not go into the trade deadline saying like, oh, well, we're probably going to be out of it. You know, I'd like to see them move forward and get fans excited. And even if they don't make the playoffs, I think you have to look at this winter as a, okay, we are going to win starting now. How do we do that?
We're on 106.7 The Fan with my pal, Britt Giroli, national MLB writer for The Athletic. And she's up on Twitter at Britt_Giroli. The underscore. Is there another Britt Giroli out there? I've never understood this. Why do you have the underscore? That thing's terrible.
I think there maybe was another Britt Giroli out there. There's a couple of, like, fake accounts with, like, photos of me, too, so don't follow those. I haven't been tweeting that much because I'm on maternity leave, but I came on and broke my silence for you, Ben.
Look, I when you said yes, trust me, it was heartfelt. I really appreciated your willingness to do that. Let me ask you this. Okay, like, for these young prospects, we're just looking at the future and their growth, and it's exciting to wonder where they're going to get. But you mentioned the money. Will they spend on free agency? Like, this is why, part of the why they had to went into rebuild mode is because the ownership was not willing to spend on Bryce Harper to keep him, on Trey Turner to keep him, on Juan Soto to keep him. It's a ways off before we have to discuss contracts for Abrams and Wood, but similar to signing free agents, at some point in a division with the Mets, who are willing to spend whatever, the Phillies spend money and so on, they're going to have to do something. What's your sense with this odd ownership deal? They were for sale. They weren't there. Now they're not for sale. What's going on there? Any sense early on here as to what they will be willing to do in terms of spending, whether it's free agents or eventually on their own young guys?
Well, if there's one thing that they have done historically, Ben, it's shell out money for pitchers. Like, they paid Max Scherzer, they paid Patrick Corbin. Like, they have done that. So if they follow that playbook and they want to, you know, buy the arms, grow the bats, then I think you're a little more optimistic because they have traditionally ownership. And I know everyone likes to say the learners are cheap. No one likes their ownership group for, you know, 90% of fan bases. But when you look at when the Nats are good, they do spend. They aren't like a bottom five payroll. They are a team that will go out and, like I said, pay for the arms. They have had trouble convincing ownership to pay for position players, to keep those homegrown position players. But honestly, if you look at James Wood, I would have signed that guy yesterday just to keep him longer if you think this is going to extend our window. You know, he certainly is one of these young emerging superstars in the game. Then I think you have to look at what would it take to keep him here. If they are going to just spend on pitching, you know, just spend on these prize free agents, then they really need to look at it. Like I said, it's this window is starting to open now because you're not going to be able to keep all those guys. And ownership, you know, historically has not paid for these position players. So it even puts more urgency to my last point about spending money this winter and finally saying, all right, we got to get out of this perennial rebuild. This team has been terrible since they won the World Series. They won in 19 and then everything fell apart. You know, we are now 6 years later. You know, people have been patiently waiting. Rebuilds have gone quicker than this in Kansas City and Detroit and Baltimore. I think for the Nationals, you know, you want to repay the fans by giving them hope and saying this is going to be it now. And so I would hope that ownership would continue to do what they've done, at least bare minimum historically in the past, and paying pitchers, and that, you know, they pair that with the young core. And I think that they're a team that really could surprise. I mean, that expanded playoffs then makes it so they don't necessarily have to beat the Mets or the Phillies. They can still get into the playoffs, which really opens up a lot of doors for teams that aren't necessarily willing to go into that top tier of spending.
And you talk about extending James Wood now. He is not represented by Scott Boras, right?
I don't believe so, no.
Yeah, so that's a huge advantage right there. Start talking. Right. You don't have to worry about the agent saying, no, we're not going to do anything until he hits free agency or whatever Boras typically does. So, yeah, that's another reason to maybe go harder at Wood. And I was going to ask you lastly about the Nats. Okay, they're 24-29. Again, they've had a bit of a surge here thanks to sweeping the lousy Orioles. What are your thoughts about them this year? Forget everything else going forward. You mentioned the wild card. We see what they're doing here with some of these younger guys. What do you think about their chances this year of actually making that kind of a run and possibly, you know, getting in as a wild card or at least contending down the stretch?
I think that they're a team that, as you said, contending down the stretch. I think they can be a team that is pesky. They can be a team that can still be in it as long as, you know, Mike Rizzo, and I don't think he would sell them off at the deadline. I think they're a team on the upswing. If they do anything one way or the other, it's going to be kind of small, like a little selling or a little buying with an eye on keeping guys under team control, thinking beyond 25. But I think when you look at them and you look at their schedule, you know, they could be a team that kind of hangs around. I still don't have them as a playoff team. I think there are too many roads to cross. And I think with young teams a lot, you run out of gas simply in August and September. That was a little bit of the issue last year. I remember talking to Ryan Zimmerman. They got off to kind of a hot start pitching-wise, and everyone was really surprised. And he was like, well, with a young team, though, the innings and the workload are going to be an issue. So, you know, I think that you always have to have that caveat with these younger teams when you're pushing these guys through a big league schedule and how draining that can be compared to the minor leagues. But I like them. I think that there's no reason they can't be kind of in the mix or a team that, like, you're looking at and, you know, ends up being four or five games out of that last playoff spot, you know, which is enough to keep fans entertained. It's enough to keep guys, you know, not totally hopeless. And I think that if they can continue to build on what they did last season and what they've done right now over the last 10 days or so, that, you know, they're a team that you can't totally write off, which, you know, is good. I mean, are they going to win the NL East? I don't think anyone thinks that, you know, that is possible as we sit here and talk on Memorial Day. But, you know, I think if you had told Mike Rizzo that this is where they would be, you know, he would tell you, you know, we want to win every game and, you know, whatever cliches. But I think that, you know, being within striking distance of 500 at the quarter pole mark where they start kind of paying attention to records, is about where I would put the Nationals.
We're talking with Britt Giroli here, of course, national MLB writer for The Athletic. Speaking of things, if you had told me at the start of the year that you said Mike Rizzo would take kind of where things are at, I don't think anybody in Orioles land would even have thought this was conceivable, that they have the second worst record in the American League at 19-34. Yeah, and that's with winning three games in a row here, getting some better pitching in the last three games, which is bizarre considering how bad it's been. The hitting's been awful. Their young talent has not looked as nearly as promising as everybody hoped. What the hell happened here, Britt? What has gone so wrong for the Orioles so far?
Well, they can't pitch and they can't hit, Ben. And I think when you have both,
if you say it like that,
not very good. I mean, I think they have a negative 92 run differential. That's more than double the Nats. The Nats are negative 48. So, you know, they not only can they not pitch, and that's been the spotlight, of course. They've had Kyle Gibson and Charlie Morton and guys who are past their prime who haven't been able to pitch, but their offense has also gone into slumps. They've had guys, Dean Kramer, they've had other guys, you know, that pitched okay, well enough to win, and then the offense doesn't score. And they'll lose an extra inning. So these are like deflating, defeating losses. And this is the reason why Brandon Hyde was fired before Memorial Day. You know, there's a lot of expectations. And I think your colleague on 106.7, the fan, Grant Paulson, had a great tweet a few days ago about how, you know, with the Nationals and their young guys, you kind of look at the Orioles as a little bit of a, like, warning story, like a little bit of like a, you know, we don't want that to happen to us, where their guys that have come up haven't taken the appropriate strides developmentally, and you wanted them all to get better. And outside of Jackson Holliday, right now none of them have really gotten any better from last year. So it has been, I guess if you go back to the last trade deadline, almost a full year of the Orioles as a whole underperforming. This young core that we heard so much about really not getting it done. And it reminds me of the Toronto Blue Jays a few years ago when the whole industry was very excited about
Bo Bichette and, you know, Vlad Guerrero Jr., and they had this really young core, and they were going to be good for a really long time. And obviously that didn't happen. We didn't see this dominant Blue Jays team. And yes, they signed Vladdy, so their window may be extended here for a little bit longer, and they are willing to spend money. But to me, the Orioles kind of have a little bit of that vibe going on, where it's like, well, wait a minute. Maybe this young core wasn't exactly what we thought it was going to be, and the front office did not go out and be aggressive. And so it's just been a really worst-case scenario on both ends. You know, they didn't upgrade pitching-wise like they should have for a team that really should be trying to win the World Series now. They made these tiny little nibbles around the corners, hoping everything would go right, and everything has gone wrong. So a lot of this is on the front office, Ben.
Well, I was going to ask you about that in my last question for you. I didn't like the way, from afar, the way Mike Elias handled the manager change. You know, didn't talk with the media for 4 days. It's not about talking to us. It's being accountable. Hey, here, you know, here's why I made the call I did, and here's where I've fallen short as well. Because, like you said,
right,
he's been, unlike Mike Rizzo, the trades have not worked at all. The pitching was questionable from the start. At least if the pitching, it's like a one-off. Like, most of these guys are not relevant for going forward, but the offense is. All these young guys are part of this young core, so it is bizarre that it has fallen apart to this degree. What's your thoughts on Mike Elias at this point? And I don't know, do we even have to discuss his job security?
Yeah, I think we do. I mean, you look at what he's done, and not just this year, like that would be a vacuum, but we are also looking at, as I said, last year. Last year at the trade deadline, they failed to do enough, you know, really went small, and those moves didn't work out. 2 years ago, they did the same thing, and they lost in the playoffs, and they got swept out by Texas, and it was like, oh, well, you know, we're going to lift off soon, and they haven't. They've continued to make really small moves, and you know, Mike Elias came from Houston, but it's important to note that, you know, Houston did build up their farm system. Houston didn't hand out huge contracts, but when they needed to, it went out and got Justin Verlander, right? Like, it went out and got Zach Greinke. Like, when it needed to, Houston made bigger moves and splashier moves, and the Orioles, outside of Mike Elias trading for 1 year of Corbin Burns, have really not done that. You know, they've really done just enough here, and so I think the front office is going to be under some scrutiny because they fired Brandon Hyde, which was, as we know, the manager is always the shield for the GM. So now all of this pressure is on Mike Elias, and keep in mind, this ownership group did not hire Mike Elias. That was the Angeloses who hired Mike Elias. So, you know, I think that there is definitely going to be a lot of things looked at and examined here because of how much of a step back some guys have taken because of some of the free agent moves that were made. You know, I have heard, and this has been reported, that ownership was willing to spend more money, and Mike Elias convinced them that they didn't need to. This was going to be okay. He had a plan, and this plan has backfired. So there will certainly be, I think, a long look at what Mike Elias has done, and you saw it in his comments. He knows he's on the hot seat. He said that they're examining all their processes, and they're going to change all these things. You know, and keep in mind, Ben, they fired a lot of Brandon Hyde's staff, coaching staff, after the season last year, which now that they have fired Brandon Hyde, they also have an inexperienced coaching staff, which is on the front office. So it was Mike Elias who made those decisions, not Brandon Hyde. So there is certainly a lot of blame to go around, and a lot of that rests on Mike Elias's shoulders.
All right, well, just let it be known for the record that when I needed to go big here to get a guest to talk about the Nats and the Orioles, I went as big as I possibly could and got Britt Jaroli here, who, of course, unlike Trevor Rogers or some other guys, has delivered. Britt, you rock. At Britt_Jaroli on Twitter, X, whatever you want to call it. Go read her on The Athletic. Always read her, whatever she's writing about with baseball. Very insightful. Does her homework, all that good stuff. Britt, a pleasure talking to you. Let's talk offline like humans do, and I look forward to that later on.
All right, Ben, thanks. And thanks for letting me do this after bedtime.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right. Britt Jaroli there. When we come back, we're going to start talking about the NBA, the draft, the playoffs, all that here on 106.7 The Fan. Love the song Enter Sandman coming in here. Metallica's actually in town, I believe Wednesday at Northwest Stadium. Somebody who's got an extra ticket out there. I'm just saying, I'm not opposed. I saw some of the when they were at Virginia Tech. Of course, that's the Hokies. Use Enter Sandman to motivate everybody, and it's It's a good song to motivate people. No doubt about it. All right, Ben Standing here with you till 9 o'clock. We're going to talk Wizards and NBA draft in a minute with our guy Chase Hughes from Monumental Sports. But, you know, typically when you talk about the NBA draft or any draft, you say, what are the needs of a team? And the thing about the Wizards is their need is talent. That's the need. I'm not worrying about almost any other position. Now, they've got some promising young players. I think Alex Sarr had a pretty impressive rookie season, Bub Carrington. And I still don't know quite if he's a real point guard or a two or a combo, whatever. Another guy, he looks ready to go from the jump. You've got Bilal Coulibaly. Of course, they're the first-round pick from this new group here. Missed about half the year with an injury, but he looks like a really potentially dynamic two-way player on the wing, and we kind of keep going from there. But none of these guys are like top-tier starters on a contender upside. Maybe, we'll see, but like they can take anything they need to. And I think that's important. Just like when you're having the conversation as we get closer to the NBA draft, it's, you know, about a month away, give or take. We get it. The Wizards got the sixth pick. They also have the 18th pick, and they're not getting Cooper Flagg. We'll talk with Chase about some of the prospects that are there and possibly likely to be there at number six. But I would not focus on the position. You know, look, there's, again, if there's a point guard that they like there, I don't think that's an issue. If there's a big man they like there, I think Sarr looks like he could be maybe a stretch five or a four. But I wouldn't worry about saying, well, we can't pick this type of player because he is there. I think the Wizards are doing all the right things right now. They finally got the owner to say, hey, we are going to, in fact, you know, tank, rebuild, whatever you want to call it, however you want to spruce it up to make it not sound so painful. The losses aren't all that fun, but this is what you need to do in the NBA for the most part. You know, what the Indiana Pacers are doing, largely staying in the league middle and then finding enough talent to move around and get all the way to the conference final for the second year in a row. That's the rare approach. It is typically the, you know, the draft picks that you get, the top five picks or so, that lead you to the promised land if you're fortunate to get there. And the Wizards are doing their part in that regard. They had three first-round picks last year. That's plus. They acquired A.J. Johnson from the Bucks in the Kyle Kuzma trade. So really four first-round picks from last year. But I would not let any of that affect what they should do with the sixth pick in particular. Maybe 18, you start saying, we have to pick and choose a little bit there where we have some depth issues. But we don't have to worry about that too much. But the question is, forget that. Let's just look at the talent. What's the best talent there at six? We're going to talk about that with Chase Hughes right after this. All right, you always have to worry when you're on the radio not to say anything that would get you into trouble. But I can't help it if Chase Hughes fires off one of his crazy hot takes that I've heard over the years, having worked with him at formerly NBC Sports Washington, or heard him talk over a beverage or two in my day. So bringing him on here to talk NBA draft and get his take, I don't know what to expect. I'm ready for anything. Who knows what Chase is going to say. But first and foremost, Chase, thank you for doing this. Covers the Wizards, of course, for Monumental Sports. Are you ready to talk NBA draft and fire off whatever thoughts are in your head?
I am. Thanks for having me. We'll see if the takes are as hot as the grills out there Memorial Day weekend.
Absolutely. All right. Well, let me ask you this, though. I just in the previous segment discussed how, for me, I don't think position really matters here for the Wizards. Yeah, you've got Alex Sarr, and you've got Bub Carrington, and Keyshawn George, and they've got some interesting young players. But at this point, to me, they're still in the talent gathering stage. This isn't like other years where you say, hey, they need to get a center or a point guard or whatever. That's where I'm at here. Where are you at with regards to that? Do you agree with that, or do you think, hey, they do need something specific?
No, I agree 100%. I mean, I think at the stage that they're at in their rebuild, they haven't really solved anything. And if you're picking this high in the draft, I mean, sixth is obviously they wanted to be picking higher. They didn't get the result they wanted in the lottery, but you're still picking high enough in the draft where I think best player available has to be their approach, no matter what position your roster's in. But also, you know, I think you got to keep in mind with the Wizards and the way they're trying to build this thing under GM Will Dawkins is that they don't really want traditionally defined positions on the floor. What they hope to have is five players who can dribble, pass, and shoot. So they don't want to have a traditional point guard. They don't want to have a traditional big man. And so I think that's got to be kept in mind with everything they do, but also for all the reasons that you listed.
All right, well, let me go through a couple of the guys that are there. Now, the Wizards have the 6th and the 18th pick. They also have the 40th pick in the second round. So if they take all three, you know, they could add three young pieces to what they already have as an interesting core moving forward. Now, I'm going to assume, call me crazy, that Cooper Flagg will be gone, that yeah. Dylan Harper, the point guard out of Rutgers, will be gone. His teammate Ace Bailey from Rutgers seems like he could be gone. And you got VJ Edgecombe, really dynamic wing guard, also seems likely to be gone. But there's still other guys who are pretty interesting. There's Trey Johnson from Texas, you know, a dynamic freshman scorer, one of the best shooters in this draft. You've got, I like the kid Igor Demin from big point guard out of BYU. Our mutual friend Todd Dibas has talked him up to me in recent days. And then, of course, there's the local kid Derek Queen out of Maryland. I don't know that he's really in the discussion for 6, but maybe. I think he'd be an interesting fit with Alex Sarr. He's a bigger body, where Sarr is that more springier athlete. Of those three guys, or pick somebody else, do you like any of those guys in particular for where the Wizards are at?
Well, I personally think Trey Johnson will be gone, so I'm just going to eliminate him for that reason. I mean, there's a chance he's there at 6, but you know, he's just such a talented scorer and might be the best shooter in the draft. I think when it all comes down to it on draft night, someone's going to take him before the Wizards are on the clock. I think Derek Queen's definitely in play at that position, but of those names, Demin really stands out to me. And right now, he's projected in mock drafts to go a little bit later than the Wizards. I've seen him anywhere from like 9 to 13. Some mock drafts have him even lower. But he's just got so much that you can't teach. I mean, he's 6'8", 6'9", without shoes, the tallest point guard or shooting guard to ever test at the combine. And he's got great feel with the ball in his hands. He's a good passer. And we know that the Wizards like players with positional size. He's got that. And guys who can create off the dribble and who can pass, and he can do those things. So I think he fits what they're trying to do. So I would not be surprised if he continued to move up mock drafts approaching draft night and ended up being someone that the Wizards would really like at 6.
So you think that Trey Johnson will be gone. If you agree with me that those other four guys will probably be gone, it really means the draft kind of starts at 6. I mean, whatever the order will be of those other guys, does that kind of make sense? That you think that like the five guys we kind of feel will be who the five will be in the top five, and then the Wizards, it kind of starts there?
I don't think the top 4 to 5 has really been solidified after 2. I really think things could hinge on what the Sixers do at 3. A lot of people think that Ace Bailey could be the pick there, but he's probably the prospect in the top 10 who's got the most mixed opinions about him, because he's got great size for what he does. He's very athletic and he's a really good shooter. But, you know, there's a lot of questions about what happened at Rutgers last year, because they had two guys, him and Dylan Harper, projected top 5 picks. And they were not a good team at all. They didn't even make the tournament. So is there something that prevented those guys from winning? Are there question marks there? He also is not a guy who rarely got any assists at all. I mean, he doesn't pass very often. So I think teams, whoever drafts him, they're going to have to consider, can we teach this guy to be more of a willing passer, a better defensive player? But he's also really young. You know, he reclassified just like Cooper Flagg. He should have been a senior in high school last year. A lot of these guys like that. So I think VJ Edgecombe might go 3rd. I think he'd be a great fit for the Sixers next to Tyrese Maxey. He'd be the perfect shooting guard to put next to Tyrese Maxey, because he's a little bit bigger. He might be the best defender in the draft. So I think that's probably the top 4, but I really think as we approach draft night, we're going to find out more about what the Sixers are thinking, and maybe it's a trade, out of that 3rd spot.
We're talking with Chase Hughes, covers the Wizards for Monumental Sports at Chase DC Sports on Twitter, X, whatever you want to call that. The Wizards also have the 18th pick, and obviously it's a lot harder to project who will be on the board there, but Thomas Sorber, the center out of Georgetown, is a name that when you look at mock drafts seems to be in that general range. He only played maybe a little bit more than half the season, had an injury that he's still recovering from, but should be ready for the season. I really like Sorber. Georgetown was a massively different team with him in the lineup. you know, he's got a really good feel for the game, big size. I don't know how much you've thought about him already, but, like, you know, should they get to that point and say, hey, we do kind of need a big man, say they went for a guard earlier on, what's your thoughts on him, how he fits in, and is that, or is there somebody else at that 18th spot that you've already kind of looked at and said, boy, if this guy's there, I think they got to take him?
I think he'd be a great fit for the Wizards at 18 if he's there, though. But, I mean, just first looking at the fit, he does a lot of the things that Alex Sarr doesn't in terms of being more of a physical player, more of a rebounder. They'd be a terrific shot-blocking combination. I mean, Alex Sarr, that's his biggest strength. And Thomas Sorber last year averaged 2 blocks per game at Georgetown. And maybe there'd be question marks about whether that translates to the NBA level, because he's about 6'9", but he measured in with a 7'6" wingspan. So he might be one of those guys who could play, you know, much bigger than he's listed. So I think he'd be a great fit at 18. You know, maybe a more of a traditional big man, allow Alex Sarr to do the things he likes to do on the perimeter, but I don't think he's going to be there. I mean, just looking at how productive he was last year and how strong of a combine he had, that 7'6" wingspan, you know, standing out and looming pretty large, I'm guessing he's off the board at that point. So if he is, you know, one guy who's kind of stood out to me is Neek Clifford. He played at Colorado State last year. He was in the game that Derek Queen hit the big shot in the NCAA tournament. Played 5 years in college, kind of a tough blue-collar, versatile two-way wing. He has definitely stood out. Another big man, Kaman Malawach, he could honestly be in play for the 6th overall pick, but if he fell to 18, I think he'd be really, really interesting. He played with Cooper Flagg last year at Duke. He's about 7'1", 7'2", really good shot blocker, has good hands around the rim. Interesting. And Rasheer Fleming of St. Joseph's, if they want to stick with a big man, he'd also be one to watch, I think. He's a 6'9", very versatile, kind of reminds me a little bit of Obi Toppin, who we're seeing play right now for the Indiana Pacers in the conference finals. He does a lot of things well, and he's improved his shooting quite a bit over his 3 years in college.
All right, let me ask you this. Okay, I think we're generally, sounds like we're in agreement that, you know, they still need just to get more talent. And when you have 6, you have 18, and a second-round pick, they can get some help there, get some more depth on this team, add these younger pieces. That said, we know everybody would have loved for them to have gotten, if not the first pick, at least 2 or 3 to get that better talent. They also have a whole bunch of other million second round picks. They got a bunch of pick swaps in the future, other picks. Any thought as to whether maybe this is a year they say, hey, can we put in some of these assets to jump into that top 3 or 4 to get an Edgecombe, a Trey Johnson, whatever that may be? What do we think the chances of that happening this year?
I think the chances of them looking into it are pretty good. I mean, they traded up to get Bilal Coulibaly 2 years ago, which was the first draft under Will Dawkins and Michael Winger. And then last year they made a trade not only to get the 14th pick and get Bub Carrington, but they also made a trade to move slightly to get Keyshawn George. So they've shown a tendency to be willing to make trades on draft day and draft night. And, you know, Will Dawkins on the night of the lottery was asked about trading up, and he said that his philosophy is kind of set your draft board, find out who you want, and then, you know, find a way to go get them. And if that requires trading up, then so be it. So you mentioned the draft capital that they have acquired. I think they wanted to get a lot of picks just because, you know, that's a good thing to do when you're rebuilding, and certainly it could give them some flexibility down the road. But I think that is something not to overlook, you know, the potential to use them to strike now, especially. I think it's a pretty pivotal draft for them. You know, their third draft in this rebuild, you don't expect to be picking that high forever. And if you're at 6, you know, that might be the highest pick that you have. You know, if you expect to be better next year, or especially the year after that, you know, you're in within striking range. If you wanted to trade up to 3, it'd be a lot easier to do that now than if you're trying to do that a year or two from now and you have a lower pick. So I definitely wouldn't rule that out. But I also think that after that top 2 tier of Cooper Flagg and Dylan Harper, there's a lot of different possibilities. And I don't know if there's a whole lot separating the 3rd best player in this draft from the 7th or 8th best player in this draft. So they might feel okay sticking at 6. And, you know, maybe their first choice isn't there, but somebody who they feel like is close enough falls to 6, and it's not worth trading up to get them.
right, Ben Standing here with you until 9 o'clock on 106.7 The Fan, talking with our guy Chase Hughes about the Wizards in the NBA draft. Let me pivot from the draft to the roster. One thing that was really interesting with this team this year was that they said from the jump, we are playing the kids. We're going to start them. All three of their first-round picks, they played heavy minutes, even at times at the expense of some of the veterans. Well, the Wizards made a bunch of different moves, and they now have in the backcourt alone Jordan Poole, Marcus Smart, and Chris Middleton, three guys who, you know, can play to are still very good players to varying degrees, and for most teams would get, you know, decent to heavy minutes. And I imagine at some point they'll probably add another big man or two just to help fill out the roster. But that said, you also want to play the kids. And if they draft two more first-round picks and you have the three from last year plus A.J. Johnson, who was a first-round pick, and Corey Kispert, right, it starts being like, well, wait, how can you play everybody? What do you think the chances are that they're able to possibly trade one of those vets to either get, you know, maybe as a pinch-up for one of these spots in the top five, as we discussed, maybe it's for future assets? Or do they think, hey, we like having all these veterans around these kids to help, you know, set the table, set the tone for these kids? What do you kind of view that aspect?
I think there's always going to be a veteran presence on their roster, but I don't think they're tied to any particular veteran player, if that makes sense. Like we saw, you know, last year you trade Kyle Kuzma, but you bring back Chris Middleton. You know, you trade, Jonas Valanciunas at the deadline, but you get Marcus Smart back. So I think they always want to have some veterans on the roster, but they're not exactly tied to the guys that they haven't drafted. But, you know, they are kind of entering a stage in their rebuild where, you know, things will probably be handled a little bit different, I would imagine, in terms of the rotation. I still think the runway is going to be there for the young guys to play a lot. But, you know, if you add another guard to the mix, as you mentioned, you know, you can't play everyone. And, you know, that didn't even, you know, I think address the fact that they view Bilal Coulibaly as a guard, you know, maybe even as a potential point guard long term. Keyshawn George, he's the size of probably a power forward, but they like playing him at the two. You know, he played the majority of his time last year at the two. So they have a lot of guards, a lot of guys that they think could continue to scale towards playing more at guard. And at some point, you know, I don't know if guys would get necessarily processed out, but I think at some point there'll be more competition for the minutes, maybe amongst those young guys. If you have a bunch of young players, you know, especially at the guard position, Bob Carrington, Bilal Coulibaly, A.J. Johnson, you could throw him in there. And then if, say, they drafted Jeremiah Fears, then it could be interesting to watch as they sort of shake out their rotation and try to see, you know, who is the cream that rises to the top.
All right. Chase Hughes, you know what? I got to say, we didn't have to even consider dropping this call at any point. He stayed on track. He didn't – no crazy takes. I was nodding along. Trust me, people, I'm as surprised as anybody. No, I kid. Chase does a great job covering the Wizards for Monumental Sports. Again, you can follow him. What is it? At Chase DC Sports?
Yes, that's correct. On all platforms, including TikTok, Ben.
Wow. You'll have to explain. I don't do the TikTok. I can't get into another platform. Chase, you rule. Thanks so much for doing this on a holiday weekend. Have a great one, and we'll talk soon.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
There you go. Chase Hughes talking NBA draft. We'll talk more about the NBA playoffs. We've got Game 4 of the Western Conference Series going tonight. We'll get into that. We'll talk Commanders and whatever else. If you want to call in, 800-636-1067. Ben Standing with you till 9 o'clock on 106.7 The Fan. All right, wrapping up this 7 o'clock hour. I'm with you, Ben Standing here with you till 9 o'clock on 106.7 The Fan. We have talked Commanders. We've talked Nats, Orioles. We've talked Wizards, NBA Draft. We'll talk a little NBA playoffs and maybe dive back into the Commanders. In the last hour, I used to cover the Wizards for many years on that beat, primarily in the John Wall, Bradley Beal era. And look, it's a long way even from that point where this team is right now. At least I think they're heading in the right direction. You know, the 76ers, you know, famous with the process, trust the process. I'm one of the people who's an advocate of that. I think people constantly get it wrong when they say it didn't work, when they point to the fact that the Sixers haven't gotten out of the second round of the playoffs. It's, you know, the point of the process is, or yeah, point of that approach is The draft is so uncertain, you need to take as many swings as you possibly can to hopefully hit on somebody. And the fact that the Sixers, got Joel Embiid, I know he's hurt now and his future is in doubt and all that stuff, but the only reason they've been in contention for the last several years is because they landed on Joel Embiid. And even though a lot of the other picks fell apart, you know, for various reasons, Markelle Fultz, Jahlil Okafor, whatever, they had this one guy, and this one guy really was the centerpiece of a team that, you know, has been in the mix for many years now. And I think that's why it unquestionably worked. I'm a believer in process over results. By that, I mean the results can be fluky. Look, I mean, the 76ers were kept out of the Eastern Conference Championship round in part because Kawhi Leonard hit that shot from the corner that hit the rim, you know, 17 times and fell in. That's what kept the Sixers out of the conference finals. You can't predict that. Injuries are typically another factor you can't predict. Now, in Embiid's case, he had injury questions early on, and that wasn't surprising. But just in general, you know, look at the Wizards. The John Wall, Bradley Beal era ended in part because John Wall's, you know, knee injuries that just, you know, wrecked his career, unfortunately. And, you know, everything kind of tailspinned from there. But the thought, the process, and I'm not saying that to be cute as in trust the process, but just, you know, what a team chooses to do is so important. And that to me is more important. You eventually, of course, have to win. But, you know, the draft is so challenging because you're guessing on what a human being, let alone a young human being who doesn't have much of a proven track record, is going to do over the next, you know, 3 to 5 to 10 years. I like where the Wizards are at. I think Alex Sarr showed me a lot last year. Same with Bob Carrington. Keyshawn George is maybe the biggest surprise of them all, considering he was picked later in round one. And A.J. Johnson coming over in that trade, the Kyle Kuzma trade, I was really impressed, especially as just a pure athlete, what he could do. But again, none of these guys to me say, hey, this is a definite starter on a team that's going to compete for a title. This is an interesting opportunity for the Wizards in that the Eastern Conference is down. I'm not talking about contending this year. They better not contend this year. They still owe the Knicks a top 8 protected pick in 2026. So they need to finish bottom 8. If they had gotten Cooper Flagg and they, you know, somehow got out of that, you know, finished at, you know, top 10 or maybe even got closer to the play-in game, all right, so be it. But not now. You still need to get that pick. So they still have a ways to go, but they've got an opportunity here. It's a bummer that they didn't get pick 1, 2, or 3, you know, based on where they were positioned after the season. But that's how it goes sometimes. I know people are like, you know, it's so Wizards. Trust me, I was one of them. But, you know, the year before they ended up with the second pick in the lottery, it happened to be a bit of a down draft. But Alex Sarr does look like a promising player. So, you know, it's not like it was all terrible. I think hypothetically you'd rather have had the second pick this year with a Dylan Harper, who, from what I gather, is projected as a better prospect. But it's neither here nor there. It no longer matters for sure. We're going to watch, or at least I'm going to watch, the Western Conference final tonight, Game 4, Thunder, T-Wolves. And I watched, of course, the Knicks rally last night against the Pacers. And, you know, to see these teams, these are not the traditional teams that we're used to this deep into the playoffs. You don't really have that obvious, you know, face of the league headliner type. I know people were hoping Anthony Edwards gets there. We'll see. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander was named MVP this year. I don't think he's the face of the league type. But my point is, and, you know, he wasn't a top 5 pick either. And I think he's still a bit of a slow burn in terms of getting maximum attention for a guy with his talent. The Knicks are the Knicks are the biggest outlier per se, right? I mean, they signed Jalen Brunson. They've acquired Mikal Bridges, Anunoby in trades. They're not really building it through the draft, but the Thunder did. And even though Indiana has not typically had high draft picks, they have largely built their team through the draft. And I think that's what you just have to keep doing. Keep adding pieces and hope that your process is sound enough that eventually you get the right guys for sure. We've got a lot more, though, to discuss in the final hour here. We'll talk some Commanders talk NBA playoffs a lot more. Ben Standing with you till 9 here on 106.7 The Fan.